Welcome to Breaking Free, a modern divorce podcast with Rebecca Zung and Susan Guthrie.
This is the place to hear other people's stories, to learn from the top experts in every related field, and to also have some fun, laugh, and hang with two girlfriends who are also top family law litigators.
And now we invite you to listen to today's show.
It's going to inspire you to transform and break free.
Welcome to today's podcast. Today's topic is going to be co-parenting with a toxic ex. What to do when your ex tries to turn the kids against you. I'm Susan Guthrie.
And I'm Rebecca Zung. And today we are super lucky to have an amazing guest for you. She's written several books. She's a foremost authority on parental alienation. Dr. Amy Baker is a nationally recognized expert in parent-child relationships, especially children of divorce, parental alienation syndrome, and emotional children of abuse. She has a PhD in developmental psychology from Teachers College of Columbia University. She's the author or co-author of 8 books, including Adult Children of Parental Alienation Syndrome, Breaking the Ties That Bond, and Co-Parenting with the Toxic Ex, What to Do When Your Ex Tries to Turn the Kids Against You. Dr. Baker offers telephone coaching for parents concerned about parental alienation, and she served as an expert witness in custody cases all around the country. She provides training to legal and mental health professionals about parental alienation and psychological maltreatment. And welcome, Dr. Baker. Thanks for being with us today.
Yeah.
It's my pleasure.
So Dr. Baker, you know, as a family law attorney, I know that parental alienation cases are really some of the most difficult and complicated cases. Can you give our listeners a general definition of what parental alienation is?
Sure, that's a great place to start. So it's a family dynamic in which a parent engages in behaviors that we refer to as parental alienation strategies or alienating behaviors. And these behaviors are likely to foster a child's unjustified rejection of the other parent. And when those behaviors take hold in the child, we then say that that child is alienated.
And how would you differentiate parental alienation from estrangement?
So the terms that we use are estrangement. We use that term to describe children who have a good reason to reject a parent. And parenthetically, children rarely reject a parent, even parents who have been, you know, physically abusive, neglectful, abandoning, molesting the child. In general, children do not reject a parent. But if a child did, we would say that child is estranged if the parent abused the child and the child rejected that parent. We reserve the term alienation for kids who are rejecting a parent unjustifiably. Not that that parent is perfect. All parents are imperfect. All parents frustrate and hurt and disappoint their children sometimes. But we use the term alienation to describe kids whose antagonism and stated fear and anger is far disproportionate to whatever the flaws are of that parent.
So are there any behavioral manifestations, you know, that would differentiate an alienated child from, you know, a child who's just suffering from estrangement, who has a reason for being separate from their parent?
Yes. So the good news is these kids don't look anything alike. The one behavior they share is that they are both resisting contact with a parent. They might be saying, I don't like that parent. I don't want to see them. I'm afraid of them. Whatever the reason is, they are rejecting a parent. That is the one thing that they share. And then there are 8 behaviors that completely differentiate estranged children from alienated children. And let me back up for a moment, if I can. The way that we can tell if a child is alienated or estranged is through what I call the 4-factor model. And all 4 things have to be in place in order to say that a child who's rejecting a parent is alienated as opposed to estranged. And briefly, factor 1 is that there was a prior positive relationship between the child and the parent who the child is now rejecting. So we wouldn't consider it alienation if the parent was away for the first 10 years of the child's life and comes back and says, I want to see my kid and they don't want to see me. That's not alienation. That's a parent who never had a relationship. So we want to see that this parent had the ability to form an attachment bond with the child, that we're a good enough parent. That's factor one. Factor two is absence of abuse or neglect on the part of the now rejected parent. We need to make sure that we don't call abusive parents victims of alienation. They're not. They're abusive parents. And although it's unlikely their child would reject them, if their child did, we wouldn't call that alienation. Factor three is that the favored parent engaged in the 17 primary parental alienation behaviors. That's a set of behaviors that if a parent uses are likely to foster a child's rejection of the other parent. Then the fourth of the four factors is these eight behaviors that kids exhibit only when they're alienated. So when all four things are present, there was a good relationship, the parent didn't do anything neglectful or abusive, the favorite parent is manipulating the child to believe the other parent is bad, and the kids are exhibiting these eight behaviors, then that child is alienated, not estranged.
Interesting. Is there a difference then, I think you kind of touched on it a little bit, between the child who's been actually abused and the child who's been alienated?
Yeah, so that's the eight behaviors that fall into factor four. And these behaviors are specific to alienated kids. They're bizarre behaviors. They're highly atypical. And I'll just give you a couple examples. So the first one we refer to as the campaign of denigration. So alienated kids, they don't just dislike a parent. They go on a vicious campaign of rejecting that parent. It's vehement. Absolute rejection. They are rude, arrogant, provocative. They tell everybody under the sun how disgusting their parent is. And that can be contrasted with kids who've actually been abused, who are reluctant to talk about the problems in their family. They don't gleefully trash a parent that they're upset with. Another element of the campaign of denigration is erasing the past. If you show them a picture of them having a good time with their parent, an alienated child will say, oh, that wasn't me. That was Photoshopped. I never had a good time with that parent. Not admit that they ever had a good time. They won't remember any good times with their formerly loving parent. Unlike abused kids who are able to remember good memories. They'll say, oh, before mom went on crack, she was great. Or before my father started molesting me, we had some good times. Also part of the campaign of denigration is an unwillingness on the part of alienated kids to be invested in repairing the relationship. If you ask an alienated child, what could mom do to fix this? Or how could dad make this right? An alienated child will say, there's nothing that parent can do. I have no interest in ever having a relationship with them again. Or they'd have to change everything about their whole personality. You know, they're very unwilling to imagine a better relationship in the future. Abused children, on the other hand, if you ask them, what could mom do to fix this? They'll tell you, oh, tell her to stop drinking. Tell her to stop beating me. I want to have a relationship with her. So alienated kids and abused kids behave very, very differently. And that's just the first of the eight behavioral manifestations of alienation.
Is there a difference in what you just described, depending on the age of the child? You know, would an 8-year-old still act the same way as a 15-year-old? You know, saying, I hate that person, I hope they drop dead. You know, is it the same?
Well, if a child is under a certain age, they can't really be alienated. You can't alienate like a 2 or 3-year-old. You can't alienate them, but it would be harder once there was a good relationship between, say, a 2-year-old and a parent. It would be harder for them to remember, oh, mommy wants me to be mad at daddy. I'm going to lie and say bad things about daddy. They're less able to be manipulated in that particular way. But once kids are a certain age, they can be incredibly rude, arrogant, entitled. I've seen it in 5- and 6-year-olds, and I've seen it all the way up to older teenagers.
Okay.
Interestingly, people used to say teenagers probably can't get alienated. They're savvy. They know what's what. They can tell if somebody's lying to them. Of course, we know that's ridiculous. I mean, even adults can be manipulated. Adults can be manipulated to join a cult and give away all their money and, you know, starve themselves and, you know, do all sorts of ridiculous things. We know that the teenage brain is not fully developed, and it is unfortunately too easy to manipulate even a teenager to believe that the other parent is a bad parent who doesn't love them and doesn't hurt them and wants to hurt them.
I know I had a case one time where one of the daughters was 17 and she had a very good relationship with the dad before the alienating started. In fact, she had even decided already, she was a senior in high school, she'd already decided to go to the same university that her dad had gone to because they had had such a great relationship. And by the time she turned 18, a year later, and was leaving for college, she had been so alienated that she changed her name and still doesn't speak to him.
Yeah.
So it was possible even at that age.
Yeah, I think the courts are a little bit behind on this. You know, we used to think that by the time somebody was 17 or 18, their brain was fully developed. And now we know that doesn't really happen until, you know, you're 25. And in fact, the ways in which the teenage brain is underdeveloped make it more likely that they would be susceptible to manipulation, emotional reactions, more able to be enticed or manipulated to give up something that's even in their own best interest. So, you know, and that kind of bumps up against the best interest of the child standards, which gives children, once they're a certain age, a say in when there's a custody dispute. And really, my sense of the literature is that that's really not a very good idea. If the parents are not able to come together to make a decision, asking a child whose brain is not fully developed to pick a parent or to pick their schedule makes no sense to me, because then the parents are more likely to start campaigning and manipulating the kid.
I think it's really fascinating the breadth of ways that the alienating parent manipulates the child or does the alienating. I know Rebecca and I, when we have talked about this, there are a number of behaviors that the alienating parent exhibits, or a number of manipulating factors that they use. And they seem to be remarkably consistent across our cases when we talk about cases that we have. Could you talk about, tell us about some of those behaviors that the alienating parent uses?
So there's 17 primary parental alienation strategies. It's not the universe. There are a couple things that maybe aren't on the list, but at this point we have a lot of research that shows these are the primary behaviors, and the research is consistent. Not only are these behaviors associated with children ultimately having distorted thoughts and feelings about a parent, but these behaviors are also really bad for kids in and of themselves. They're very, very damaging to children. And I can just, you know, I don't know if I have all 17 memorized, but, you know, obviously it's denigrating the other parent, interfering with the child's parenting, you know, time to be with that other parent, interfering with communication, cell phones, blocking emails, etc. Something that I call interfering with symbolic communication, which means making it difficult for the child to talk about, think about, or look at pictures of the other parent. Referring to the other parent by his or her first name, that is, you know, seemingly such a small thing to do, but it's very powerful because it's telling the child, basically, this person isn't an authority figure anymore. They're no more important to you than anybody else you would refer to by their first name. Other examples are referring to a new partner as mom or dad. So it's installing a replacement parent.
Yeah, I've had that one. Here's your new mom.
Yeah, allowing the child to choose whether or not to go to parenting time. I mean, parents don't allow their kids in general. They don't allow them to choose whether to go to school or not because they value education. They wouldn't allow the child to choose whether to wear a seatbelt. So the kids know when a parent allows a child to choose, the parent is saying, this isn't that important. It's not, you know, it's discretionary. You could take it or leave it. So it's conveying a very powerful message that they don't value that other, you know, the child's relationship with that other parent. So those are the kinds of behaviors. Other examples include asking the child to keep secrets from the other parent, spying on the other parent, withholding information from that parent, undermining that parent's authority, conveying to the child that the rules and regulations, the discipline strategies and values of the other parent are stupid or don't have to be followed. When you put those 17 behaviors together, they incite conflict between the child and the targeted parent. They create a psychological wedge. They create a cohesion between the child and the parent doing it. And then depending on how the targeted parent reacts, it's going to lead to a breach in the relationship.
If a targeted parent is starting to see signs of a few of these things starting to happen, what would you advise them to do?
Yeah, that's a great question, because too often people call me, and you might have this experience as attorneys, people, you know, show up for the first session and they say, you know, I haven't talked to my kid in 5 months or 5 years or whatever. And I always feel like, oh my gosh, I wish we had a time machine and we could get people at the beginning of this. So if you suspect, if a parent suspects that the other parent is undermining your relationship, the first thing to do is to start to keep a journal and document what is going on, which of these 17 behaviors is occurring. Is there a pattern to it? Are they becoming more frequent? What's your evidence? Do you just believe it? You have a hunch, somebody told you, your kids are telling you, you have it in writing. You know, it's really important that you pay attention to what I refer to as levels of evidence, so that you know, do I have confidence that this is really happening? And if so, how often is it? Often, sadly, it's even worse when people start to take a look at it. There's a little bit of denial sometimes, like, oh, it's not that bad. So what if he's calling me by my first name? And yeah, sometimes he lets the kid choose, but my relationship is rock solid. Nothing can affect it. And so that is sadly not true. You can have a great relationship with your kid and you can still lose that relationship because of the efforts of the other parent. So number one strategy is, or advice, is to really document, see what you are dealing with. The next thing that I advise people to do is get an attorney soon, because the last thing you want to do is be served with papers and then have 2 weeks to find an attorney when you're incredibly stressed. It's very hard to find the right attorney. You want to make sure the person has real deep knowledge about alienation and really knows how to help you manage this very complicated situation. And so I suggest that people find attorneys while they are not under the gun. The next piece of advice is to look at yourself and not assume that all of your conflict with your kid is coming from the other parent. It's easy to say, oh, things are dicey between me and my kid. It must be because the other parent is, you know, causing trouble. You do have to look at yourself, and that's part of keeping that pattern, you know, keeping that diary and seeing what the pattern is. Maybe you're actually contributing. That would not feel so good for the person, but in a way it's better news, because you have control over yourself and you don't really have control over the other parent. So yes, you want to be savvy about alienation. You want to know what those 17 strategies are. You want to know if it's happening, but you also need to see, are you being as compassionate and thoughtful a parent as you could be?
Is there any sort of therapeutic intervention at that point that would be helpful? Could the alienated parent or the parent who believed they were being alienated reach out for therapeutic assistance?
Well, a lot of therapists don't really understand alienation. And so sadly, a lot of them, you know, make things worse by saying, you know, oh, just let your kid go live with that other parent if they want. They'll figure it out, you know, and that actually isn't such a good idea. So there is targeted information. Some of it's in my book, some of it's in my coaching. Other parental alienation experts have their own way. But in my experience, if your ex is turning your kids against you, you need parental alienation, specialized knowledge as soon as possible. Because targeted parents often inadvertently contribute to the problem. They don't cause it, but they exacerbate it. And so they really need somebody, whether it's a therapist or a book or a coach or whatever, somebody who really knows how to help them navigate this without making it worse.
Is it common for you to see the targeted parents say, well, I don't want to upset the children, so I don't want to force the issue and make them spend the whole weekend here. You know, they really do have more friends closer to mom's house or whatever that is, and just kind of not want to upset the apple cart or not want to, and try to keep the peace in their own lives as well. What would you say to that person?
I think it really depends on the situation. So if there's no alienation going on, but legitimately the kids want to spend a little bit more time, they're tired of it being 50-50, the other home is closer to school or their friends or their dance studio or whatever, and the other parent is supporting their relationship, then I say, you know, think about it. Seriously think about what's best for your kids.
No, I'm saying if there are signs of alienation, what would you say in that case?
I would say work on the relationship with the kid and maybe say to the child, you know, I'm concerned that if you go, you know, if you spend less time with me, how are things going to get better between us? Let's give it a couple months and see if we can really work on our relationship. I want to understand what it is that isn't working for you here. And then let's look at it again. So let's give ourselves 3 months to really try to turn things around. And then that parent really needs to get some heavy duty support and coaching to see if they can do it.
So you mentioned earlier getting a good lawyer, getting involved in the legal system. Certainly Rebecca and I know that process and we know how difficult it is. Have you found the courts to be particularly well educated on this subject and able to intervene?
You know, I don't think there's any courses in law school on parental alienation, right?
No.
So,
no.
And it's not even mandated in continuing legal education. No. I know I've done some continuing legal education, but in New Jersey, and I've done a little bit in, I think, even in Florida, and I've done it, whatever, around the country, but it's very hit or miss, ad hoc. I know that most judges, by the time they get to the bench, they really have not gotten a solid background in alienation. And the reason that's important is because there are certain aspects of alienation cases that are counterintuitive. And that's also true for mental health professionals. So you could have a very, very seasoned therapist or a very, very seasoned attorney or very seasoned judge. But if they're not a subspecialist in alienation, what they will do is draw on their basic knowledge that they've developed over their years about what works in other cases. So right. Maybe in non-alienation cases, it is generally he said, she said, and it's hard to tell, you know, and both people are to blame and all those sort of cliches that might be true in many, many cases. They're not true in alienation cases. There is a parent who is intentionally or otherwise engaging in behaviors that are undermining the child's sense of safety and security with the other parent. And the other parent, although they're flawed, they're not causing their child's disaffection from them. And unless the judge really understands, there's a subset of high conflict cases that are very, very different, and it's not he said, she said, and it's not both people are to blame, then they're going to treat the alienation cases like their garden variety high conflict cases, which means that they will think they succeeded if both parents walk away unhappy. That's sort of the general, I've even heard guardian ad litem say that, like, well, it was a good case for me because everybody walked away unhappy. Well, I'm not sure that's the mark of a success. The mark of a success should be that the cause of the underlying problem is identified and dealt with. And that can't happen in alienation cases unless the judges really get it. And if I can just go on for a moment, part of what makes cases so hard for legal and mental health professionals is that targeted parents come across as very unlikable. You know, we talk about the four A's. They're anxious, They're afraid, they're angry, and they have an agenda. And the agenda is, look, my kid's being alienated from me. So they're very intense. They sit on the edge of their seats and they interrupt their attorney and they interrupt the custody evaluator. They are not always good listeners. You know, everything reminds them of some horrible thing the other parent did that they want to tell you 400 examples of. And that's the kind of thing that a therapist or a custody evaluator or an attorney or the judge will think, ugh, no wonder these kids don't want to be with this person. She doesn't listen, or he's very aggressive, you know, he's not likable, he's very tense. You know, these people are traumatized. Some of them have PTSD, years of being misunderstood and maligned and interfered with and undermined and losing their precious child. By the time they show up in court, they are not necessarily in good shape. And the judges sometimes make decisions based on how likable somebody is on the stand. And of course, the alienating parent's going to be more likable. Everything has gone their way. They have the kids and the money, you know, sometimes, and the house and the cars, and they've got it all. They have control over their kids. They have constant access to their kids. They're the preferred parent, which probably feels pretty good. You know, we say that the alienating parent is calm, cool, and collected, and then as compared to the targeted parent. So if judges don't, again, going back to the basic question, if judges don't understand what it is counterintuitive and specific about alienation cases, they're going to fall back on their tried and true strategies for dealing with these cases, and it's going to be a disaster.
So we just have a couple of minutes, but I just realized we didn't even touch on something that I think is really, really critical. And that is that, and I learned from you when I heard you speak a few years ago, that parental alienation really is a form of child abuse. And if you could elaborate on the manifestations in the child, what kinds of things happen to them? What is the impact?
Yeah. So the definition of psychological maltreatment, which is the kind of abuse that alienation is, we use the definition developed by the American Professional Society on the Abuse of Children. And their definition of psychological maltreatment is caregiver behaviors that result in a child feeling unloved, of value only in meeting somebody else's needs, damaged, defective, and that's what happens to kids who are exposed to the 17 primary parental alienation strategies. At the end of the day, these kids end up feeling like there's something wrong with me because mom didn't love me, or dad is no good and dad is part of me, so then I must be no good. Or mom only loves me when I, you know, throw dad under the bus. So that's not really love. So for a variety of reasons, the 17 primary parental alienation strategies induce in children a belief that they really are unloved and unsafe. And the long-term effects of psychological maltreatment are very well established. Shockingly, it is to many people, it is actually more damaging than any other type of child maltreatment. The long-term effects are worse, even in sexual abuse, which many people feel like, oh my God, that must be the worst thing to ever happen to a child. Well, the research actually shows that psychological maltreatment has longer lasting effects. It's associated with depression and anxiety and eating disorders and a host of bad outcomes for kids and adults. And one of the things that I say to a judge when I'm on the stand is, you know, if we were here for the sexual abuse of a child and the child was 16, you might be tempted to say, oh, they're almost an adult. Or you wouldn't be tempted to say in a sexual abuse case, well, they're almost 18, so let's just leave it alone. But that's how judges often respond when it's not sexual abuse or physical abuse, but it's psychological abuse. They often say, well, the kid is 16. They're going to age out soon. It's too late to do anything. especially if the child's doing well in school, the judges don't really want to intervene in cases of alienation because they don't understand that psychological maltreatment is actually more damaging, even in sexual or physical abuse.
Wow, this has been so, so informative. And I mean, I feel like we could have you on again, maybe down the road, because there's so much that we didn't even get to. But it's been so enlightening. So enlightening.
Well, I appreciate your interest in the topic. It's great when attorneys really want to know about this. It is a subspecialty. It's not taught in law school. So, you know, you're performing a great service in making the information available to people.
Well, I think it's going to be really helpful to our listeners to hear about this. Can you give them some information on how they might reach your resources or reach you so that they can get more information on the topic?
Sure. So my website's my name, amyjlbaker.com. And that's my email address, amyjlbaker@AOL. My phone number is on my website. I do expert witness work. I've done some consulting for parental alienation cases, and I coach targeted parents. And I love when I get to, you know, really help a parent reconnect with a child or help them inoculate a child from becoming more alienated. That's, you know, prevention is really the key here because the negative effects are just so devastating for children and for the parents.
So early intervention is as early as possible, right?
Yes.
Well, thank Absolutely. You very much, Dr. Baker.
Thank you.
Thank you for joining us today on Breaking Free, a Modern Divorce podcast. I'm Rebecca Zung.
And I'm Susan Guthrie. For a limited time, get your free copy of Rebecca's best-selling divorce book, Breaking Free, a step-by-step divorce guide to achieving emotional, physical, and spiritual freedom at www.breakingfreethebook.com.
And for your free copy of Susan's Top 10 Reasons to Mediate Your Divorce, visit www.divorceinabetterway.com.
Check back next Monday for our next edition of our powerful, inspirational, and educational podcast. And if you enjoyed today's podcast, please remember to give us a 5-star rating on iTunes and let us know what you liked in a review.
And remember, you're just one step away from your new life.